G'day, Gladys and Potties roll up for another classic LNL. We go back to 2007, the year we went to East Timor, spent a week there, and this is an interview with our interpreter for that trip, Sayo. G'day listeners, welcome to LNL, and we are very privileged tonight because we are going to be granted an audience with Her Majesty, the Queen of Timor. We've dealt, of course, with the President, we've dealt with the Prime Ministers, plural, tonight, Her Majesty. This is someone we got to know very well as we wandered around East Timor. You know her voice already, our interpreter, Sayo. Now, this is a woman of beauty, of carriage, of character, who commands respect wherever she goes. And her name is purest Portuguese poetry, Maria de Sayo Lopes de Silva. And she's much, much more than an interpreter. She's a polyglot. This woman speaks six languages, Tetun, English, Bahasa Indian, Portuguese, French, and, I've forgotten the other one, Spanish, I guess. And she started one of the first NGOs to go back into East Timor, as the Indonesians left. She's currently writing a book of short stories based on her experiences with the resistance movement during the 90s, and we thought this was the perfect way to conclude our series on East Timor. Now, fortunately for us, she took 2 weeks out in October to work with us, and it was her translations that brought to life the stories of the many people we met. Indeed, we came to realise through her work that the East Timorese, from the most remote villages to the capital, are highly articulate. But you really need a good interpreter to know that. Like so many East Timorese, she's had an eventful life. The daughter of a dissident lawyer and journalist, you'll learn more about him in due course, she grew up on a small island in East Timor. She studied in Jakarta, raised a family here in Australia, was an active member of the resistance, moving between Australia and East Timor, and co-founded the NGO Timor Aid, which, as I said, went in as the Indonesians were moving out. Now, throughout our long hours on the road together, I got to know many parts of her story, and I wanted her to share them with all of you. Your Majesty, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Philip.
We must start with the story of your formidable father, cast out into the colony of East Timor by the Portuguese, like being, you know, thrown into onto Devil's Island, really. Tell us about your dad.
Well, he was a huge character. He was very well known. His name is Mario Lopes de Silva. He was highly political. He was not a refugee. He was a political deportee from São Tomé Príncipe, where he was born, is a small island in the west coast of Africa, and then to Guinea-Bissau, transported to Portugal, and through all the way to the confines of the earth in East Timor, soon after the war.
So Salazar wanted him out of the place.
Yeah. As far as they could get him was East Timor. And that was not enough, because when he arrived, they gave him a small plantation coffee in Railaku near Ermera. We passed by in our last visit last time. But he was not happy, so he came to Dili to harass the government and to protest. And then they discovered Ataur, and they said, wow, if we dump him there, he can't come out. And that's exactly what they did.
I think one of the great anecdotes is his magisterial arrival in a boat, a rather special boat. Tell us that story.
When he was deported again from Dili to Ataúru, the government passed a law stating that he had no right, or he could not use government transport by sea or by air, which means there was a small light plane at the time that flew to Ataúru whenever the authorities decided to go there, and there was a barge. So he was not allowed, forbidden by law, to use those transports. And Ataúru had only little fishing canoes. And my father was huge, He was 2 meters, very heavy.
2 meters in every direction, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was tall, he was big. I remember he was mentioned to me, he was 115 kilos when I was 9, 10, 12 years old.
And he had a personality that fitted the bulk.
Yeah, and he was very resilient, of course. He said, well, I have to find my way out of here, because he, in Atauro, there was how many people at the time? I don't know, but maybe less than 4,000 people scattered throughout the island. There was no other way of communication except radio. So radio linked him to the world. And he asked around the local people who could build bigger boats than they had. And somehow he gathered a number of boat builders, and he built a huge korakora of, you know, those, if you remember those big boats, sailing boats from Sulawesi, celebs in the past. And some of them still coming into the Australian waters for fishing and stuff. So he built that, a 4-ton korakora. And with that, he made his magisterial entrance in the capital of Dili. He, as the korakora came in, there was the Portuguese flag on the korakora, and obviously the curiosity of Dili in the, at the time, who is that? So the government, the police, the secret police, PIDE, the military, even the governor could not resist the curiosity and came down to the beach, to the shore.
What a welcoming committee.
And then, yes, and then he crawled out because he built a tiny house on top of the korakora, so to protect him from sun, wind, and the elements of the sea. And immediately the governor said, oh, you know, you are not allowed to come to Dili. And he said, no, you said in your law that I cannot come to Dili with government transport. This is my transport.
I understand that he called the this proud vessel the Perseverance.
Yeah, that was the Perseverance 1, and then he built 6 Perseverances, increasing in the volume, I mean the tons.
I like the way he persevered with Perseverances.
Yeah.
Well, you obviously adored him.
Oh, yes. You know, he's someone I really, until today, you know, I said my father was my man, the dreams of, I always had about a man. That's a man I wanted in my life.
Someone as fearless, as outspoken.
Yeah, yeah, fearless, outspoken, with whoever. And he was a defender of the underdogs, you know.
Of course, your father had a family, wife and kids, back in Principe. What happened to them?
When my father was in Railaco and settled, so he asked the government to bring his family over. And obviously it took a few years, and the government sent the secret police to Saint-Domé, a Principe, and to interview my half-brother, you know, my eldest half-brother. There are 2 brothers from his first family. And they introduced themselves as good friends of my father. So my stepbrother opened his heart and spilled the beans. So the secret police returned to Portugal, and they only made a sentence of their reporting to the government, saying if the father was like that, the sons are worse. And that was it.
Have you ever met your half-brothers?
Yes, I did. I did. The first time was one holiday to Portugal towards 60s, late 60s, but I don't recall very well. But then I met him again in Paris in 1983, and then I went 1984. And in 1989, we became very, very close because he is the spitting image of my father, in many senses, yeah.
You're listening to Classic LNL and to an interview with Sayu, who helped pave our paths through the jungles of East Timor back in October 2007. Tell me about your mum.
My mum is from Mermera. She was the daughter of a chef, you know, local tribal man. And he hated my father with guts because my grandfather, maternal grandfather, was very, very traditional. He refused to be christened. I was told by my mother that the priests, the nuns, you know, at the time trying with evangelization and to Christian everybody. And my grandfather refused and chased them with his horse and his spears. So it was quite a nightmare. And when my mother married my father, he disowned her practically, and he said he didn't want to see her again. And then he was taken to Atauru, and I don't know, because he died before I really met him. So I don't know. I only know the stories. I regret that I never had a chance to meet him.
Your mum ran the family business, didn't she, which was distilling a palm wine into spirit.
Yes. There was, we had a canteen, as we call, but it is not, we didn't sell food. We sold a lot of things because there is nothing in the island. And my father brought very basic needs for the local islanders, clothing, food, because Atauru is very dry, is rocky. And because he had very good friends as well in the Portuguese government, you know, he had a balanced support there. So they allowed him to do business. So the distilleries was the biggest thing. And then he did lime with the corals and fishing, you know, dry fish. And we had a small business also.
I should point out to the listener that this palm wine is ubiquitous. Everywhere we went together, there were the roadside stalls with this milky-looking raw stuff and then the urine-coloured, slightly distilled stuff, and by all accounts, a toxic brew.
Yeah, when it's distilled, you transform into like a vodka, alcohol for the hospitals, pharmacies. So he did quite a good business of that.
So I remember you and I standing on a beach and we're looking across the sparkling waters towards the island of your childhood, and you were remembering great happiness, sunshine, fishing, being carefree.
Yeah, I think the reason I keep going back is I think I just couldn't leave. You know, I'm Australian, I'm okay. I'm very grateful to this country for having given me so many opportunities, but I always missed the quiet life, the simple life, very small community, where everybody knows each other, where we rely on one another for everything. Because when we have the rain season, like now it's starting, and the seas are rough and the wind is strong, no one can come to Dili. So it's very isolated. And I remember a life of tranquility, of peace, on the beach all the time with the fishermen, children, playing in the corals, fishing, eating the best seafood in the world for nothing practically. Mm. And I remember when I arrived in Sydney for the first time in 85, I passed by an Italian seafood shop and I saw the price of the lobster and I let out a scream. And the Italian said to me, "Signora, che passa?" I said, "What? $25 a kilo?" He said, "Oh, that's cheap." I said, "Oh, God, with that money, I'll have 20 in my country."
Yeah. Well, that's something else about your country these days, because as well as the palm wine, in the late afternoon, do you remember we'd be driving or strolling and every other kid would be carrying wonderful, glowing, jewel-like fresh fish?
Yeah. That's something I really miss, the seafood of Atauru particularly, because here I buy the fish but it's frozen, it doesn't taste as, you know, in Timor, in Atauru I get a fish, put it in water, put a bit of salt, put a bit of oil, and it has a wonderful taste. Here we have to temper it so many condiments in order to taste something.
Stop talking food, I'm getting very hungry. So you leave the island for educational purposes, don't you? You go to a boarding school in Dili.
Yeah. First, I went to Ermera, my mother's land. I was 7 years old, grade two, I think. And I went to a boarding school of Dominican nuns, mainly Spanish. And after that, I went to Dili, yes, for the rest of junior school. And
how did you get on with the nuns? Were you a bit of a handful?
Yeah. I think not only me, we had a crowd in Dili particularly. I remember I hated sewing, and in Ermera I escaped in the afternoon after the classes, by 3 o'clock, the bell would ring and we'd come together to do sewing, handcraft. And I was so terrible with sewing that I kept running away. I managed to escape until the nun set me with a piece of cloth that took me 3 years to finish. So my mother put that on her mantelpiece to remind me of my lack of skills.
Did you ever raise theological issues? Did you ever question church teachings?
Sometimes we made fun of nuns and priests, but I think it was more of because of teenage, you know.
Just being naughty.
To high school, you think you know the whole world, you know everything. And because we lived with them, so we were told not to do this, not to go out, not to do this. So sometimes we rebel. But we didn't question. Nobody in Timor questioned God. We take it for granted. And I still believe, and I have deep faith, and I have witnessed how faith has helped Timorese to survive.
I tried to talk you out of this, but failed miserably, I remember. Now, let's move on to when you're 16 or 17, you're back home. The Portuguese government is sort of beginning to pack up, and we've got the Declaration of Independence by Fretlin in 75. Your dad, of course, is a very big listener to the wireless. He was apparently an avid Radio Australia listener.
Oh, yes.
So he gets to know what's happening.
Yeah. And when the Indonesians invaded Timor, we were in the island, thanks God. I didn't witness the horrible things that my compatriots had to go through. But when the Portuguese government arrived in Atauru, they practically ran away from the whole situation. My father was in Dili. So when the governor came out of the barge, the first question I asked was, where is my father? And they pretended that they didn't know he was in Dili. They said, oh, what a surprise. We thought he was already here. So I started crying. And the following day, you know the hotel Dili stayed, the Gino Favaro's hotel. His father had a light plane. And the governor asked him to drop my father in the island the following day.
I understand he refused to shake hands with the departing Portuguese.
Yes, he did. But he was so sad at the time. Because in the morning of the invasion, 7th of December, we knew nothing. It's amazing because people in Dili said, oh, there was these boats and warships, and we heard nothing. And Atauru is only less than 40 kilometers from Dili anyway. And my father had the radio at 4 o'clock because he wakes up every morning at 4 o'clock and he tunes into it. And there was, at the time, Radio Australia in French language to the Pacific. And he said, they have come in, they are already in Dili. I said, who they? And he said, well, the Indonesians apparently. Because, and the radio went on and on and on. Like, I remember for 6 months was the news that the first item, you know, the headlines that came on Radio Australia at the time in French language. So that's how I knew ABC. I got to know ABC. And the day of in the invasion, the Portuguese were packing. We went to the church, and people after the church gathered outside and start talking about, you know, the Indonesians have gone into Dili. And the Portuguese kept packing, and there was a company of paratrooers and some Navy people. And they said nothing at all. And by 5 o'clock, when they were already packed and in the warship, the military commander came to my father and said, oh, Mr. Mario Lopez, you know, we have to move away to the international waters. We have to be, I don't know, it's 25 kilometers on, something like that. And my father said, why? Do you own this place or you don't? Why do Indonesians come in? You have to move out. And then they said, well, you have a chance to come with us, with your family. And my father just shook his hand. He said, look, I didn't ask anybody to send me to Timor. I came through the door, and I will leave through the door. I will not jump out through the window. And he refused to shake hands with the commander, and for the first time I saw tears on my father's eyes, the first time in my life.
Your brother, of course, is involved in the story now. He's in the Timorese army at the time of invasion. What happened to him?
Yeah, he is now in Atauru Island very quietly, living the life that I always desired to have. I envy him anyway. He was in the Portuguese army upon the invasion. And but at the time, obviously, he stayed like everybody else. And they were they left for a wedding of one of their colleagues in Fatukama, up on the hills. You know, the statue of the Christ?
How could I forget it?
Yeah.
Tiny but exquisite.
Up the hill. So, and they couldn't come down. My brother was very lucky because he was supposed to be in the headquarters. It was his shift night. And one of his colleagues said, well, you know, if you have this birthday, you can't go because you'll be on shift tonight. What about if we change? You get in on Monday night and I will do the Sunday night, which was 6th to 7th of December. And they said, yes. My brother said, oh, thank you very much. That will help. Because if he stayed, you'd have died. Because that colleague that stayed on the night shift died. Was shot dead.
Your mother, of course, was grief-stricken, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, because we didn't know where they were about. And my mother, I was wailing every morning. And, you know, those beautiful memories, the wonderful childhood and the youth, and suddenly shattered. And the cries and the wailings and the tears and the suffering started to come in into the family and at, like, every Timorese household.
I'm going to just interrupt the flow of the narrative to go back to the statue of Jesus and tell the listener that if they visit our website, they will see this great ferro-concrete monster looming on a headland. And it's one of the great ironies that this statue of the Christian Saviour was given to the East Timorese by the Indonesians in a sort of a blundering attempt to, of cultural sensitivity. Now, to a large extent, you were protected from the initial brutality of the invasion because you were on the island. But when did you become aware of the scale of the dreadful happenings?
Well, I'm very fortunate, and I thank God for the rest of my life for this, because the trauma that my compatriots have faced, seeing people being shot at, corpses laying on the ground, eaten by the dogs, and I had the luck of not seeing any of that. However, we heard the bombings. Every day we heard the bombings, 6 in the morning to 6 p.m. So I'm relating all these things in my stories for the future. And we start hearing things because the fishermen and some people got the boats and went to Dili. And we heard people being shot. We heard, but, you know, one thing is hearing and another thing is seeing with your own eyes. Mm. It's totally different. It changed. It makes the monstrosity, you know, multiply 1,000 times probably. And 77, for the first time, I set my feet in Dili. And as usual, I went to see my convent, the high school, looking for my friends and colleagues. And I start saying, oh, this one was dead, this one is in the bush, this one has left Australia, this one has left Portugal. And the environment, obviously, was completely different from the last time I left Dili in July 75. And then I start hearing the stories. But the first time I really came close to the brutalities of the Indonesian army was when they decided to send about 10,000 political refugees to Atauru.
This is when you were working with the Red Cross?
Yeah. I was studying in Jakarta at the time. I was already a student in Indonesia. I came for holidays. So it was the month of June, the first barge, 1980. The first barge appeared with like 300 people, some from Dili, the majority were from Manatutu, Bikeke, Baucau, and Los Palos. And the most fascinating thing I remember at the time was this old man coming out and, you know, with his hands, fist up in the air, and he said, send us wherever they want to send us. I die, even in Atauru, I will die in my country. So I'd never seen anything like that. So I said, what is this? So I asked the military commander, the engineer, said, what is this? He said, oh, we don't know. We have to ask Dili. We are waiting for information. And then this lady that everybody said that she was about 100 years old, they just carried her down the barge. And she was talking, she was saying, oh, my husband died here. The Portuguese brought my husband from Vikeke to Atauru after the 1952 rebellion. and he died here. So I'm so happy that I'm going to die with him. And she died the following day. So all these, suddenly these revelations to me were quite extraordinary. There was a part of Tim that I was not aware of. And to see old men and women displaying such courage, I think it that there was a time that I began to ask a lot of questions and I became aware of a lot of things that the Indonesians were doing.
Classic LNL, ABC Radio National, and this interview with an extraordinary woman, Maria de Seo Lopes de Silva, first broadcast in December 2007. She was LNL's interpreter and guide on our visit to East Timor in October that year. As we talk, the ambiguities, the contradictions between the relationship of the East Timorese with the Indonesians will emerge because it's by no means a simple story. The Indonesians had, by some measure, been pretty reasonable colonialists, as you and I travelled the country, for example. Yeah. The network of roads that they'd pushed through the jungles was impressive, now completely destroyed. Yes. And, of course, the power lines. I mean, I'll never forget all those akimbo power lines everywhere that had taken electricity to many of the most remote villages, now wrecked, the lines pulled down. But a part of the process was the large-scale education of young Timorese like yourself. That's why you went to Jakarta.
Yes. Well, no doubt there was a huge difference between the administration of Portugal and Indonesia. Portugal was too far away and didn't have the resources to build Timor, I mean, to make developments, particularly roads. As you know, they are very expensive and quite in difficult terrain.
No, impossible.
Yeah. The Indonesians were close, and I know Kupan, if they bring the material from the West Timor, and they were already a country with certain development undergoing. I mean, Indonesia today is totally different from that time, but compared to East Timor, Indonesia was highly developed, no? That's how we saw it. Yes, they built roads, they built many schools. The problem is they didn't pay attention to quality. Their intention was to show the world that they were doing a lot of good things in Timor. Hospitals, clinics. You went to many clinics. There were no doctors. so when did they?
Well, that's, you know, you can't expect everything, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, and but at the same time, they encouraged education on women's education, and because many women became widows because of the war, families torn apart. As you know, we have our population, the majority is women in East Timor, in today's Timor. So women started to emancipate, you know, no planning, there was no concerted feminism effort and campaign. Things just happened because of the situation on the ground. And thanks to that, we have many Timorese who are educated.
Mm. You said tanks for that. That reminds me of the tanks in Jakarta. I remember you telling me that when you arrived there in 78, there are these huge student demos against Suharto. Tanks, soldiers on the rooftops on campus.
Yeah.
I mean, wherever you went, there was trouble.
Yeah. It was 1978, one of the elections, presidential elections. So there were already students, Indonesian students demonstrating against the Suharto regime. And I just walked into this lion's den, and I walked into the University of Indonesia, and I saw tanks all over, you know, outside, inside the campus, troops on the roofs. And I said, God. Mm. And I remember I had a white pair of jeans on me, and my brother, when I left, had printed East Timor on the back pocket. It's East Timor and with a little star in the middle. So I just pulled my blouse and to cover my back pocket, and I just walked. I walked backward so that the military wouldn't see what I had written. And then I got a bus. I went to the. I was also in a boarding, students boarding from the university, and I rang the person in charge of my scholarship, and I said, what do I do? He said, no, just stay calm, don't worry. When it's all over, we'll tell you when you go back to school. So that's what I did.
You studied sociology, anthropology, history, etc. But you talked about being disturbed by the constant bombardment of Suharto's, and indeed Sukarno's, five principles.
Yeah, I remember I studied with zeal in our life, because my parents didn't want me to go to Jakarta. Absolutely not. And there was a priest. He's still alive, thanks God. He's 83. He's going to be 83 next year. And he has been always like my second father to me. And he said, go learn the language, meet the Indonesian people, because here is a military occupation. And that was Father Monteiro. And I said, well, then he said, oh, no, you go. And then I'll come. When every time I come, I'll visit you. And he did just that. So I went there with a new motivation and desire to learn Indonesia, to understand Indonesia. And so I did history, I did a bit of anthropology. And then on the second year, one of the subjects was Pancasila, which is the ideology of Soekarno.
Indonesian state, the foundation document.
Yeah. And the book was so thick. And because in East Timor, at the time, we heard so much about Pancasila, I was so traumatized that I couldn't open the book beyond the first page. I couldn't read it. And if I failed Pancasila, I'll fail everything. When I went on holidays and the people, the prisoners that came from other islands at Atauru, I just dropped school, yeah. I dropped the uni and I decided not to go back. And the Red Cross came and they said, at the time I spoke French, none of English. And they said, well, could you be a volunteer interpreter? I said, yes. And that's when I discovered all the burnings, the torture marks and everything.
Your great father, this giant of a man, dies in Dili on December the 7th in 1981, which is the sixth anniversary to the hour of the Indonesian invasion.
Yeah, that was very eerie. Before he died, he had worked to arrange for the Africans, you know, the former colonies, people. The Africans formed the former Portuguese colonies from Cabo Verdeans. There were more people from Cabo Verde than any other African former Portuguese territory, some Mozambicans, and he worked to get those people out because the countries became independent, and they sent them over. So when finally the Red Cross had all set up, the week before their departure, he died. So that was quite symbolic as well, but the fact that he died on 7th of December at 2 o'clock in the morning, the time of invasion, was quite eerie, I can tell you.
Let's move on in your story. Tell us about your role with the resistance in the early 80s, because you married your husband in 1983, and just as you'd gone to school with a couple of Jeunanne's sisters, he had a long association with Ramos Horta.
Yes, when I came to, I arrived in Sydney in 1985 in January. I had one baby, my first daughter. I didn't speak English, so it took me 1 year to adapt and learn. And because I interrupted my university schooling, so I decided that I should go back to uni no matter what. I did that. The following year, 1986, I continued. I went to Sydney University, then I had my second daughter and transferred into New England University and then to Darwin when we moved here in 89.
I think it's interesting, you know, that you and I were that close, because New England University is just up the road from where I live, because we didn't meet for a long time.
No, we didn't. It was not meant to be at that time. Mm. And Then there was someone who was very active in the resistance, at the time supporting Fretling. And he was looking for someone to translate a tape that came from the mountains, from Radio Fretling, as it was called at the time. And somehow we got involved with that. And that we got involved in the translations of David Bradbury's film, Buried Alive. But Sydney was too far away. So in 1989, Timor was open to the world for the first
time. Quote, unquote, that was the official name of the process, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Opening up to the world.
Opening up to the world. So we just packed our bags and moved to Darwin to be closer, just in case. And Until the Hawke government came to power, Ramos Horta and his colleagues were not allowed to come to Australia under the previous government. So as soon as the Labour Party came into power, they allowed them to travel. And I remember I met Horta for the first time in a pub somewhere in Sydney. And we managed to talk, but, you know, I didn't have contact yet with the resistance inside, and the resistance inside was still very low-key. We didn't have a leader yet of the caliber of Shanana, and it took quite a while. So when we came to Darwin, you know, that's how we started contact with Ramos Horta. And then we came to Darwin in 89. I remember I got my Australian citizenship, and I left the following day.
Oh, you wouldn't get it these days. You wouldn't pass the cultural test.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know enough about Don Bradman.
No, I, so I waited 2 years. I got my citizenship, and the following day I got in a plane and to Dili. And that's when the first time I started here in Shanana, Shanana, Shanana. I said, who is that? You know, Shanana, never heard his name before, because I knew him as José Alexandre Guzmán, but not Shanana. And so, no, these are the nom de guerre, you know, the code names. Oh, fantastic. So someone said it or could make to be a mediator, you know, communication line. So
sure,
I said, oh,
sure.
I wrote a little note, and I said, look, my name is such and such. If you don't remember me, I'm very good friends of your sisters, Manuela and Armandina. What can I do? That's how it all started. I don't know exactly on the first time.
And what then happened. Then you became a sort of a shuttle diplomat and a bit of a spook, really.
I was more a spook than diplomat.
Yes, yes. Yeah, but the story, you know, you're telling us about your relationship with the family reminds us that everyone, really, in East Timor seems to know everyone else.
Yeah, that's how the small places are. You know everybody. Everybody is either a distant relative or extensive family.
But Shanana leapt at this opportunity. You get a message back and you're employed.
And yes, and he gave me my nom de guerre, as they said. A few I couldn't pronounce, and I said, Jesus, give me some name that I can pronounce. It is very difficult. So then I got in touch with the other commanders, David Alex, who died, Connie Santana, you remember, we went to Ermera and saw his grave, the current brigadier, Tar Martin Ruek. I met him somewhere in a river hole somewhere, and I loved it. I really loved it.
I've got to ask you a very personal question here. What's your nom de guerre?
I had three. As I said, the first one I can't pronounce, so I can't tell you. The second one, Shanana made fun of me and called me Charlie Lima. Charlie Lima stands for Cel Lopez. And then I was called the Sweet Waterhole, Bemider.
That's a lovely one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous.
That was not sweet at all.
You're listening to Classic LNL. And my guest, Maria do Céu Lopes de Silva, our interpreter and guide in East Timor back in 2007. You know, we ended our trip to East Timor in the Santa Cruz Cemetery. I'll never forget that experience. You took us there, and in this blinding lights of the white concrete tombs everywhere, there was a single, simple black cross. And half an hour later, you and I and the crew were all in tears because people were bringing those little bunches of flowers, thousands of them, and it was an endless line of people coming in to remember those that were massacred, many of whom, of course, have never been found. When did you hear about the Santa Cruz massacre in 1991? Where were you?
I was in Darwin. I'm here, no? But I was very much involved with the leading up to it, the preparations. I went in September 91 with a huge mission. Horta gave me instructions, letters for Shanana, for the bishop, and some message for the youth, because by then things were already heating up to that tragedy. And that's there at the time was I met Max Stahl.
I should point out to the listener that Max is one of the people we talk to. You can see him on the website. Max Stahl is a very glamorous gentleman who is a fine sort of, if you like, combat photographer and who, thank the Lord, was there at Santa Cruz to tell the story to the entire world.
I met him for the first time. I didn't know his background. I only knew he was a journalist or filmmaker. And the fact that I could speak Spanish, immediately we teamed up, and he said, well, you know, I've heard people are sleeping in the cemetery of Santa Cruz, hiding from Indonesians, because the Indonesians were knocking every doors at night, nighttime, early hours in the morning, to arrest people. So people escaped and went to Santa Cruz to sleep on top of the graves, because the Indonesians yet could not figure out that it was could be a hiding place. And so I already arranged some interviews with young people, but Max was there, so he found his way. So when I returned, because I couldn't stay more than a month, that was a tourist visa for a month only, and we're not allowed to extend. So I went to Bali because I had another, I had to meet students in Bali, Timorese students, and you know, do a few things with them at the time. And then I get a phone call from now because Max had to leave as well. He came to Yorkshire Television, if I'm not mistaken. They all left. He decided to stay behind. He said, no, something has to happen. He felt that something was going to happen. Mm. So he stayed in Darwin at my house while I was still wandering Bali. And then I went, before I left Bali, he rang me and said, look, I'm coming back. They are coming. So he was flying from Darwin, Brunei, Jakarta, Bali, Timor. So the last time I saw him at the time was at the airport of Kupan, where he gave back his computer to me to bring it back to Darwin, because he decided it was very, very dangerous. He had a lot of files and a lot of articles. And then we followed the news. We were on the phone. And people in Timor, there was a buzz of activities waiting for the parliamentarians to come. Shanana was in Dili getting ready for to be interviewed by the Portuguese and so forth. And then early in the morning, I think it was ABC News who broke the news that there was a shooting in the cemetery of Santa Cruz in Dili, and nobody had any idea what had it. The phone lines were cut off. We couldn't ring Dili. We tried to spend a whole day trying to get in. We couldn't. And there was the journalist who, I think it was a Dutch journalist, who brought Max's tape out in Jakarta.
Yeah.
She made a quick phone call. She said, Jesus, it was horrible. A lot of people were shot. She said, we fled, but that's how it happened. So, and then the following day, we managed to make a few calls and start finding out how bad it was.
Let's remind the listener how bad it was. Hundreds are slaughtered in the cemetery. And hundreds of others are then hunted down in hospitals and massacred in their beds. It was beyond belief, that act of savagery. And yet, one of the odd things, and I want to spend a bit of time talking about this ambivalence about that East Timorese have with the Indonesians. Straight across from the Santa Cruz Cemetery, there was that other cemetery honouring the fallen Indonesian soldiers in East Timor. And to my astonishment, it is not vandalised, it's clean and well looked after. How can you explain this? These mixed feelings?
Well, first of all, in the traditional culture, people respect the dead. You know, the ancestors, the graves, the tombs, anything related to human beings, particularly dead people. Traditionally, you know, in Dili or in East Timor in general, people are poor. But if you go and see the graves, they're constantly being taken care of and built, you know, simple things, but they make it nice and put flowers and put the photographs, and it's a constant communication with
them. So vengeance is not carried out on dead Indonesians.
But what for?
But that's something else. I remember Horta, Ramos Horta, taking me on a short motorcade of three Prados through Dili. And he was telling me that even during the recent troubles, when there was such upheaval, such carnage in Dili, that the Indonesians who live in Dili were in no way singled out, were in no way a focus of hatred or attack. And people don't think, I don't think people realise there's still a substantial Indonesian population in East Timor, and they're fully and wholeheartedly accepted.
Yeah. The thing is, people must realise that we, the Timorese, we were at war with the Indonesian army. That was the enemy. And no one, even under the Indonesian occupation, no Timorese, no guerrilla force intentionally killed civilians, Indonesian civilians. Never. Even the people who went there to cut down the trees and smug logs out of the country, the guerrillas found them, held them for one or two months, indoctrinated them and told them about the story, but let them go. So it was the army. The army was the enemy. And that was it. It didn't extend to the nation, because remember that most of Timorese went to Indonesia to study. So they had relations, some married Indonesians and vice versa.
That augurs well for the future, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Between people and people, the relationship is great.
So there's a nice little story that I want you to tell us, and it's about how you were being watched by Capacis in the 90s. You were under surveillance, and how subsequently you befriended the watcher, who then showed you some of your intelligence file. It reminds me of that recent wonderful film on the Stasi in East Germany. Tell us about your surveillance.
Well, I knew that I was going to be watched all the time, every time I went to Timor. And only one time, in 1995, it was very obvious. I stayed with my cousin. She had a small restaurant at the time. It was very convenient because people came in with excuse for meals, and we could sit down and talk and exchange some conversation and other things. And the doctor, it was a military medical, you know, he was from Copassus, he was a captain. And every morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, he turned up at the restaurant. I mean, first day,
I didn't accept that, of course, yes.
But then the second, the third, and the fourth, and I told my cousin, hey, what is this guy?
Perhaps he just fancied you.
No, I didn't know, and I was always very careful. And she said, just forget it, just let them in. How can we tell them to go? It's impossible. Then I was, you know, pretending to be very smart. I turned to him and I asked, hey, doctor, do you have nothing to do? How come you are here about 8 in the morning? You don't have patients to look after. And, you know, it's a bit of a problem when you arrive in the morning and we are not properly up and we have to wake up earlier because you are coming at 8 o'clock. And he just looked at me with his wry smile and he said, do you prefer me or somebody else? And immediately my radar said, problem. And then I said, why? What are you saying? And he said, look, you are being watched. Every Monday mornings, we, the officers of Copassus, we have a meeting about you particularly. Who did you talk to? Who you were with? Where did you go? Who did you meet? So if I'm here, I'll tell them that, no, it's fine. I've been there every day. Nothing abnormal so far has happened. But if you want, I can send somebody else. I said, please don't stay.
Ah, how wonderful it'd be to be surveilled by such a charming gentleman.
Oh,
and later on, he flashes the file at you.
Yeah. And then he said, your file is only 3 pages. And he's very confused. But Dina and Armandina, Dina is my cousin, Armandina is Sonana's sister. God, he says, thick, very thick. And so he told us who has the phone numbers, people's phone numbers to ring, and he told us how they were listening to the phone conversation. So, you know, you always find one in a million, but there were good guys. Very, very few, but I was privileged to meet one at least. And we remained friends so far.
And your thoughts on reconciliation and the pursuit of justice?
Well, that I do believe that it's practically the source, the main source of all the problems we have it now in East Timor. Something has to be done. As I write my stories, I cried, I laugh, because I can. It brings me back to the pain of people, because at the time when I visited East Timor under the Indonesian administration, I got in touch with so many people, the resistance, the activists, the food soldiers, the double agents, practically everybody that was involved in it. And hearing how their parents were killed, shot dead, you know, a father to intimidate the children not to continue with the politics. They round up the whole family and shoot the father in front of the children. So they say, if you follow him, that's what you're going to get. You know, that's enough to turn you back and join the resistance.
Your people have survived the Portuguese, the Japanese, the Javanese, and lately their big problem has been each other, which we've discussed at great length in the series. As you look at your tiny new little nation and its problems, are you confident that you're going to make it?
We will. No matter how and how it's going to happen, but we will. As we mentioned very briefly about justice, yes, we have to have justice, particularly for those people who have given their lives. And that cannot be ignored. People who lost everything, entire families. Material side, we Timorese, we don't care. You know, we have been always poor. We are happy if we get a bit more, if we have a better life. Yes, but human beings, you cannot exchange them. You cannot make them come alive again. And it is a whole generation or two that have gone for the country to be independent. And I hope that the leaders of East Timor will remember, because the Timorese people keep fighting, and they have showed, and they will fight until they get that. As simple as that.
You're a great lady, and it was an immense privilege working with you. I have to thank you. You made it possible. And would you be kind enough, Maria, to say a Lopez de Silva, to thank Chico, your admirable driver. I've never seen anyone do a better job under more onerous conditions. I'd also like to thank Graham Hill. Now, listener, you've not met Graham. You might glimpse him on the website. Graham can best be described as thin. He has the most spectacular haircut I've ever seen. It's one of those avant-garde haircuts where bits are shaven and bits stick up and they're all painted different colours. Graham came with us to do the video recording and to do the satellite uplinks and all the rest so that we could get the programmes to air. And he was so thin and looked so feeble, and my God, he was a tough little bugger. And what he did was nothing short of miraculous. Have a look at the website and you'll see. Graham, if you happen to be listening, Graham Hill, you were terrific. And Chris Bullock. Chris is the executive producer of this program, and every couple of years, Chris and I head off somewhere. Chris has a passionate interest in the region, so we might go to the Solomons, now East Timor. And the preparation, the months of work that goes into an epic like East Timor is quite awesome. So it was one of the highlights of the year for me, one of the best things I think Late Night Live did. Go onto the LNL website and you can see the postcard of Sayo with her island in the background and get to see what a remarkable woman she is.
Thank you, Philip.
You've been listening to the final program in our East Timor series, first broadcast in 2007. We'll be back with another classic, same time, same place, next week. See you later.